Hi guys, welcome back. This is February the 13th, that's right, the horrific Friday the 13th. Hopefully I will not suffer the bad luck that is associated with that. I guess it's not a holiday. What do you call it? A cursed day? Cursed day? Anyway, I hope you guys are not having bad luck either. So I thought I just finished up this really lengthy article for Retro Magazine. You've probably heard of this magazine. I think I've mentioned it a few times. I've actually contributed some pieces to it. I did an interview with Richard Garriott in an earlier RPG-focused episode, or issue. This time I've done one about the history of the adventure game, the rise and fall, and rebirth, I guess, of the adventure game genre, one of my favorite genres. You know, I think I've probably played more adventure games over the years than any other genre. Doesn't mean I remember much from all those games, but I definitely played my fair share of them. And anyway, I could talk more about that article in a bit here. First, though, I wanted to talk a little bit about this podcast itself. I've talked to you guys a lot on Facebook and on the Patreon site about, you know, where exactly what I could do with this podcast. And a couple of you suggested that I either just make it free for everybody or at least release a few free episodes every now and then, just to kind of keep the feed alive on iTunes. And, you know, who knows, maybe there's some people out there that would sign up for Patreon if they knew what they were missing out on. You know, in addition, of course, to supporting the show proper, you could get these podcasts and hangouts. I did a really awesome hangout the other day with Neil Halford. And you guys can still see that if you go to the Patreon site. You do have to be logged in to see the post, but I believe it's all there, and you can just watch a recording of it. But for these, I thought I would just, maybe I'll try this, just put it on iTunes and on Patreon and see what happens. But guys, if you're not a Patreon supporter, and you like Matt Chat, you watch the show, you know, really, it's there's no real excuse not to support the show. You know, you sign up for whatever amount you think the show is worth. Some people are signed up for as little as a quarter per episode, so I guess they're either really poor or they don't think the show's worth that much, but, you know, I don't ask a lot. You know, I know some of you folks just aren't in a position to do that, which is fine, which is one of the reasons I went with Patreon. So whatever amount you're comfortable with, you know, if you have a little more money, fine. If not, though, every little bit helps, and I always really appreciate it. All right, so enough of that. Let me see, what to talk about first here. In my last episode, a lot of you guys had commented on or wanted to hear me talk more about this generation gap between gamers of my age, which I'm assuming you're probably, and I got a couple of guys and probably maybe some girls that listen to this podcast who are substantially younger than me or substantially older, but I'm pretty sure most of us fit within the 38 to 50-year-old gap. So I'm getting kind of close to 40, so I'm thinking somewhere like 30. Most people are probably either 35-ish or at the high end 50-ish, you know, and I'm kind of curious. I don't really know what the demographics are. Every now and then I'll hear from someone who's only 18 or 19, but that seems to be pretty rare. I think if I were going to make another demographic, though, you know, actually, I think at this point we're probably on the older, we're probably considered the old guys. When it comes to gamers, believe it or not. And we've kind of moved beyond this sort of where my younger brother is at the moment. He's 7 years younger than me. So somewhere in that 25 to 35 or maybe even 21 or 23, somewhere in there, there seems to be a break-off point. And then you have the youngest gamers who are, you know, teenagers right now on up to about 20 or 21. And, you know, I can see some pretty clear differences between all three of those. And we could probably come up with some more, you know, we could fine-tune this a little bit. Some people obviously aren't going to fit comfortably in either bracket. And even within our generation, I think we're, what, Generation X, maybe? I always get confused about those. But there seems to be a break between the, and I've noticed this for a long time, a big break between people who grew up playing computers, you know, Commodore 64, or Atari ST, the Amiga, or Apple IIs, and GS, Macintosh, PC, you know, DOS. You know, it really doesn't matter which. If you had a computer in the house, and you played games on that. Maybe you tinkered around with some productivity. Maybe you even tried to program some. I know I did. I mean, who can resist that? Trying to program a little something in BASIC or whatever you had. But there seems to be a difference in those type of gamers and the console crowd. Not so much the Atari guys. It seems like there's a little bit more seamless transition between people that grew up with it. If you started off with, say, a 2600, and then from there moved on to an Atari 8-bit computer or one of those other computers, you seem to have a lot more in common with me and our, I don't know what to call it, the computer game generation, than you would with somebody who went from the 2600 straight on to an NES and SNES. And I think really the dividing line there is whether you went with the Japanese side of gaming with the NES and the Sega TurboGrafx or whatever, or if you stuck with the Western side of the equation. Because you definitely notice, you know, so many games for the Nintendo are Japanese in origin. And, you know, I think that's, while I'm on this, I don't know if you guys have been watching my Ed Freese interview, but he made some comments about this Japan versus America, East versus West. What's the word here? Boundary, I guess, or a difference, I guess. Just, you know, how are they different? But he is the example of, you know, what if you had grown up and for whatever reason, the only kind of show you'd ever seen on TV was an anime, right? And then suddenly you saw a Hollywood film. You know, the Hollywood film would strike you as being really strange and weird and foreign, right? And then, of course, the idea was, you know, flip that around. What if the only thing you'd seen was, you know, familiar Hollywood hits, blockbusters, and then suddenly here's an anime? you know, even if you grew up with, you know, watching those shows, those little kids' cartoons and Transformers, G.I. Joes and whatever, I think there's actually some anime artists maybe that worked on those. I'm not for sure. But still, you know, when you sit down today like me, I watched practically zero anime as a kid. I watched a little bit of Robotron or whatever that was, the series. I forget the name. I watched a little bit of that, a little bit of, what else was it? There was a couple movies, Warriors of the Wind, something like that. I think that's been remade now as a Princess Nausicaa or something like that. And, you know, I'd watch a couple of movies like that, but really, I was really far removed from anime. So recently, I've sat down, now that Netflix has all these animes available, and I sit down there and try to watch these classic, you know, beloved anime titles that everybody raves about. You know, my students that are, you know, they're like 18 to 21 or whatever, you know, they live, eat, and breathe this stuff, right? You know, and I sit down and I try to watch one. I've been watching one called Bleach lately, and apparently this is pretty mainstream. It's not really, I don't think it's really considered all that weird. You know, it gets a lot weirder than that, but, you know, and I can follow along, but it's still very strange to me. Now, I'm guessing if you watch a lot of anime, you probably have lost that feeling of, you know, how this is not typical cartoons, right? It might just seem familiar to you at this point. You sort of lost that foreign vibe to it, right? It just seems natural to you. You're used to seeing it. But there's so many parts of it that I'm just scratching my head. I'm like, what the heck is that? You know, why do they, you know, I'm just constantly puzzled by it. And my wife is even worse about that, you know. She's just always asking questions, just, you know, can't watch a couple minutes of it without just being really bewildered. And I'm guessing that if we brought somebody from Japan over here that had only watched, you know, anime, and then we showed, you know, are there any, even any Western cartoons left that aren't, you know, sort of infected, if you will, by anime? I don't know. But if you showed them, well, I don't know, something like the Smurfs, who knows? They might have that same kind of reaction, right? Or even Transformers or G.I. Joe might strike them as a little slow pace somehow or a little too westernized. is that a word? And I guess you guys probably that know a lot more about this, these interconnections can probably help out with this a little bit. But anyway, Freeze's point was it didn't really matter so much back in the 80s and 90s because the video games were so simple graphically. There was very little story. The dialogue, you know, was in little snippets. You know, we had the jokes about the horrible English translations, you know, that whole "all your base are belong to us" meme. All of that kind of stuff was there. But really and truly, I mean, it's a shmup, right? If you got some cutscenes in there and the translations are wonky, you laugh a little bit, but then you move on. It's not really critical to the game, per se. But as the technology has advanced, you know, they've got more and more room and better quality graphics, and they can put more dialogue, and they can focus more on story, and they can have a more of a movie-like feel to it. Well, then suddenly it does, you know, start to recognize how those elements are no longer just sort of bonus material or just filler or flavor kind of stuff, but you know, it's actually kind of important to, you know, to get that right, and it has to mesh with the player's background, the cultural background, or they're going to have that sort of foreign vibe, you know, this, well, what's, what, you know, kind of a sensation going on all the time. And his point was that the Xbox was kind of the point where the, formerly the computer game culture, the stuff that you would have grown up with if you had the computers in the house, crossed over into the console, really kind of blurred those boundaries. So now if you grew up with an Xbox in the house, you played all those Halo, Gears of War, basically games made in the West, that in some ways, I guess, differentiates you from the guy with the PlayStation and the Nintendo that's only played the Japanese games. It's not that different from the guy that only watched anime to the guy that only watched, you know, American TV shows. There's going to be some differences between the way those two guys think about games, the type of things they enjoy about games, the stuff there. Their tolerance thresholds will be wildly different. They just have totally different priorities. And it seems to me that the younger you skew demographically, the more Japanese-centric the American gamers go. So if you find one, say there's a gamer that's 25, 22, 21, somewhere in there, they're perfectly fine. They're perfectly at ease playing a Japanese game, regardless of the any kind of cultural barriers. For them, they may not even perceive these as barriers anymore, right? They're comfortable, and they actually prefer that kind of environment. The Japanese role-playing games, for example. you know, whenever I look at cutscenes from the Final Fantasy games, it's hard for me to get beyond like how Japanese it is, right? Even the ones that seem to be a little more on the Western side, it's almost like the Japanese stuff really stands out to me and distracts me. Whereas for these folks, it's the opposite, right? It would be the Dragon Age or Dungeons and Dragons style art that would seem odd to them. So I think that's one of the reasons why I'm sort of happy that there's Kickstarter out there now, because you know, I'm not sure that there's really that much room left for guys like us that do like the more American style computery kind of games. You know, it seems like there's just not a lot of interest in that sort of game from these younger generations. You know, they're perfectly happy to play these imports and to watch anime. They've sort of kind of given up on America, or at least given up on Western products. You know, it's almost kind of alarming, you know, how much more they prefer the Japanese side of things. But I don't know if it's necessarily something to be alarmed about or not, but you know, it is kind of curious to me why that is. But anyway, enough about that. You know, as always, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. If you watch a lot of anime, I'd like to hear from you. And you know, are you sort of do you sort of prefer, now that you've watched all that anime, do you sort of prefer that look, that aesthetic? Are you able to watch American TV shows without some kind of like a sort of jarring distraction going on, or is it seamless? Maybe you don't even notice. Maybe there's no effect and I'm just completely full of crap, which is always possible. Okay, let's see. What else did I have on my list here? Oh, yeah, so the adventure games. So I wrote this article for Retro Magazine. I just turned it in. And by the way, guys, if you haven't subscribed to this magazine, you just don't know what you're missing out on. Go look it up. Just look for Retro Magazine with Mike Kennedy. I mean, the layouts of this thing are fantastic. It's like the sort of computer games magazine you always wanted back in the day, where it would have all the gloss and the shiny, you know, pictures and screenshots and everything, but also at the same time have that sort of in-depth look, you know, the really intelligent articles. It always seems like you could never get the two, right? You either had a magazine that was kind of boring to look at but had really intelligent articles, or the other extreme, something that was beautiful to behold but would have, you know, these tiny little snippets, and, you know, half the time those would be wrong. So I think Retro Magazine, they finally got it right. And, you know, there's just no reason not to support those guys. I'll definitely put a link on the show notes here so you can go check that out. But anyway, the point of this article was to look at, you know, how did the adventure game start? What made it so successful? Because, I mean, there for a while in the, I would say up through the, up to maybe the late 80s, early 90s, was kind of its heyday. Of course, before that, I don't really talk about this in the article, but before that, you had the text adventure game. And that was, for various reasons, really huge all throughout the late 70s and early 80s. It had a surprising staying power. But then, somewhere around the mid-90s, the whole interest in the genre sort of collapsed. I say sort of because I've always wondered if it was the gamers turned away from it, or if it was just that these adventure games weren't receiving the love they deserved in the press, they weren't getting the attention, and that kind of led to just being less available. People just didn't know they were even out there. Maybe that had more to do with it. But anyway, in this article, I'm talking about a special type of adventure game called the point-and-click adventure. And there's a little bit of debate about this. You know, you can try to define a type of game, right? And there's always going to be these exceptions, and it seems like you can't ever find a game that just totally epitomizes the definition. And you know, there's always a blurring of the boundaries. But anyway, when I think about a point and click, I have in mind mostly something like The Secret of Monkey Island, the first one, where you're clicking on the screen where you want Guybrush to walk to. And then at the bottom of the screen, you've got those verbs, you know, words like look at or pick up or whatever down at the bottom. You click on those, and you can click on items in your inventory. So basically, you could control the whole thing with the mouse. You don't have to use the keyboard. I'm pretty sure you don't have to use the keyboard at all with lots of these games. And I could be wrong. For example, there's one of my favorites is called Shadowgate. You know, I had the creator of that game, Marsh, on Matt Chat not too long ago. And, you know, even that's probably like 90%. I'd go so far as to say it's probably 99% mouse-driven. But there's a couple spots where you have to type a spell or communicate with somebody, and a little text pops up, and you have to put in the text. But, you know, for the most part, these are just Windows-driven. And they represent kind of a positive and a negative for what came before that. Because right before that kind of game was out, you had what you would call a text graphics sort of hybrid game. I don't know exactly what they're called. But think about the early King's Quest games where, you know, basically use the keyboard. There might have been some that used the mouse for this, but you'd use the keyboard to move your character around. And then you would hit, I think, Enter, or there was some way to bring up a text parser, and then you would just type in the command. So it was kind of like playing an adventure game in text form, but instead of reading the textual descriptions, you'd just see it on the screen, and you can walk over there to it, and I think it had some kind of a basic, you know, it would know where you were if you were close enough to pick up the object and so on. So that was kind of a step in between the two. I think it was it's King's Quest V where they finally made this transition, or Sierra did, to full point and click. But anyway, the stink about it was, and this is Josh Mandel from the interview I did with him. He did the Freddy Farkas game, and he voiced King Graham. But he was saying that it was really hard for the puzzle designers when they went from that text parser, where basically you could just have the player type in anything. You know, as a puzzle designer, you could think of almost any scenario. And, you know, basically the player had to figure out what verb to use, right? So was it a, you know, operate, use, stick something, wrench something, you know, that, you know, you got a whole dictionary of possibilities, right? And so you could make a lot more, you could have a huge variety of puzzle types. And, but then when they went to this other interface for King's Quest V, and also, by the way, when they had to remake those first few King's Quest games and they had to sort of retrofit them with a new interface, they had to change up the puzzles. So suddenly, you know, you had a very limited number of verbs. And, you know, on the positive side, that made it a lot easier to play the games, because if you got stuck, you could always just go back to the old, you know, try everything on everything, trial and error approach, and figure something out. But on the negative side, it did obviously simplify or narrow the possibilities, at least according to Josh, of what was possible. Now, I don't really, my personal thought is limit away. I'm fine with having a limited array of verbs. I never really enjoyed this whole guess the synonym situation. And sometimes there's just so many possibilities, so many different ways you could solve a puzzle. There's just no way to ever guess what the developer, the designer was thinking at that particular moment. So you just get stuck, and that was the end of the game. But anyway, around the mid-90s, I think that's probably the high point of the genre. That's when you've got the sort of my favorite games of that point-and-click adventures. I love the Monkey Island games. I've played pretty much all of those. There might be one. I don't know if I ever played the last one. But I definitely played the first two or three of those. I love Full Throttle. Huge fan of that game. I really like the Sam & Max. Sam & Max Hit the Road. That's a wonderful game. Day of the Tentacle. I even liked Maniac Mansion, although it's kind of debatable whether that's a true point-and-click or not. So those are all the Lucasfilm, later LucasArts games. Now, with the Sierra stuff, I played the hell out of Police Quest. I had that on my Amiga, but I did not have King's Quest or any of the other Sierra games for the longest time. Just didn't happen to have them, so didn't get to play them. Probably would have liked them all. So not really as familiar with that side of it. Really didn't start to get back into Sierra until the Gabriel Knight series came out. Now, I was dating a girl at that time that was really into those, so I'd play those with her and really enjoyed all of them. I really, really like the second one's probably my favorite. It's got the full motion video. Now, I know full motion videos kind of gets poo-pooed nowadays. People laugh at it, but I don't know. It just really worked for me. I really enjoyed the game. The werewolf story was fun. You know, it's just, I had a lot of fun with that game. So a lot of people seem to prefer either the first or the third one, but I think the second one is probably my favorite. Never really played Phantasmagoria. I've booted it up a few times just to kind of look at it. And definitely something different. But basically, I started to get really into adventure games after, you know, they were dead, basically. I mean, I remember buying a Gabriel Knight 3 when that came out. And that sort of felt like the last gasp, really, of the mainstream adventure games. I'm pretty sure that was the last big point-and-click adventure game. I do remember after that buying I didn't get this. I remember going to, like, I think it was Walmart, you know, many years later, and they had this sort of budget games section there. And in and amongst the sort of hidden object games and the, you know, all these bejeweled clones and all this big fish type stuff, there was a game called The Longest Journey, you know, out of this, I think a Norwegian developer. You know, and I took that home, and sure enough, it was like a good old point-and-click adventure. But it was even sort of better than that in a way, because it was, the storyline was, it was very mature. You know, you could tell this wasn't like porn, okay? But it was written, you could tell it was written for adults. You know, they weren't trying to be kiddish, childlike with this at all. I really got, you know, it's been a while since I played it, but I just remember how sort of psychoanalytical it was. You know, it was very deep. You really got to have a really close connection to the character April in that story. I just really love that game. One of my favorites. I made the mistake of trying to have some students play it. And, of course, you know, they thought that they didn't think it had aged very well or whatever. They just couldn't get into it at all. But you know, what can you say? Generation gap. Again, I think it's a great game. And then shortly after that, I was sort of on the lookout after that. You know, I'd go to these, every time I was in Walmart, I'd go straight to that sort of budget section. And, you know, 99% of the time, there'd be no adventure games. But lo and behold, one day, a sort of double pack shows up, right? So two games in one pack. And it's a Siberia 1 and 2. I never heard the series before, but it looked like it would be pretty good, so I took this one home. This was Benoit Socal, I think, is the author of this. And I believe these guys are out of France, Microids. But anyway, another just brilliant game. Oh, man. It had all these. I remember the sort of theme was toys and sort of had a steampunk-like feel to it, and the graphics and everything. Let's see, what's the name of the character? I think her name might be Kate. It has been a while, but anyway, another great game. Loved those. Really, I played all the way through those. And after that, I was really hooked. And it was just, you know, it almost got to be a little metagame. Like, can I find an adventure game? Can I, you know, of course, you got the classics. You go back and play. You know, I went back and played a few classics. But, you know, I really wanted the, you know how it is. You don't want to just play old games all the time. Sometimes you want the new. Something new, even though it's an old genre. I knew that somebody out there must still be making these. I mean, these had to come from somewhere, right? So I got connected to Philip Yong. Actually, not sure how to pronounce the guy's last name. Woo, but anyway, Philip, got connected with him over at Adventure Classic Gaming, and I introduced myself to him. Real nice guy. I think he's based in Australia. And I started to, you know, I told him, you know, I want to play more of these games. I don't know exactly where they're coming from. And this is kind of early internet days. There, the internet was around, obviously. But it just wasn't quite as, you know, it wasn't quite as comprehensive as it is now. So you had to actually know people to get information sometimes. And so I was talking to him, like, you know, how can I get more of these games, right? So we, you know, I started to review games, and he would send me the games, and I would review them for the site. And I mean, I remember just being blown away by the variety of these. There were people out there making sort of standard point-and-click adventures. There were the Broken Sword games. Well, that was actually out of Revolution, who did Beneath the Still Sky, which I, you know, unfortunately, you know, it doesn't. Don't you have those games, right, that you know about? You know, you should have had. There's no reason you didn't have them, but they're just gaps. Like, why didn't I have Beneath a Still Sky on my Amiga? It kills me, you know? But I just never had it, never played it, didn't learn about it till well after the fact. But anyway, those guys made a Broken Sword series. Very cool set of adventures. I played all of those. And then there was some, let's see, there was the Still Life games, that was so-called. I really had a good time with those. I really liked the first one. And then there were some that were more fun than really deep or immersive. You know, I wouldn't say they're must-plays, but I really like the, what's the name of it? I think it's called Return to Mysterious Island. Really fun game. I mean, I got a bunch of these here. Most recent one I think I played was called Deponia. I got a whole shelf full there. I should go through those. Yeah, there's one here called Physicus. The cool thing about this one is it's kind of like Myst, so it's not a point and click. But I'll mention it anyway because it's such a cool concept. So basically, this physics professor made this game as kind of edutainment, basically to make physics fun. And I'll be damned, he did a fantastic job with this. I mean, even if you don't know about physics, you're scared of physics, you know, you'll learn a little bit about it playing this game. I really highly recommend it. I wish it had done more. I mean, it looks great. It looks just like a Myst game. But you know, I played a ton of those Myst clones, played all the way through the Myst series. Again, those aren't point and click, so I didn't talk about them in my article. But I really enjoy those kind of games, too. And those, of course, led to my Nancy Drew fixation. You know, that kind of came about. I remember, again, I was at Walmart or Target, one of these stores, and I was just dying. I wanted a new adventure game. It's so hard to find the damn things. And they had one of these Nancy Drew games on budget. And I'd avoided that series because I kind of assumed it was some kind of kids, you know, series for young girls only. So I hadn't really even paid it much attention, but I think they had something like game number 17. Like, wow, there's a lot of these. And they had it down for like a couple of bucks. I'm like, you know, okay, a couple of bucks. You know, how bad can it be? If I hate it, I can always, you know, just throw it in the garbage. So I started to play it, and what was amazing to me was, you know, I thought it would be this easy peasy little girls, little kids game, but actually it was, you know, right up there as far as challenge level with all these other adventure games. I mean, you could really, it took some time to get through these, and I had my wife, she got interested in it as well. So we'd play them through together, and she'd solve some puzzles, and I'd solve some puzzles, kind of navigate the thing. And it kind of got to be this sort of couples bonding experience playing these Nancy Drew games. And you know, my wife gets really obsessed with some of these puzzles. You know, she's been up all night before trying to solve one. You know, then generally when you wake up the next day, it's like, oh, boom, I know exactly what to do. But, you know, you don't want to give up, so you stay up all night trying to do it. But those are fun, too. But, yeah, all along this trajectory, though, all these developers are saying the adventure game is dead. The adventure game's a niche market. You know, it's... I think, let's see, when was that last Myst game? I think there was a Myst 5, End of Ages. I think that's the last time I can remember buying an adventure game at a, you know, that wasn't on some kind of super budget aisle. You know, just a new release, full price, you know, the $60 or whatever the games cost. That's the last time I remember that. And ever since then, it's been, you know, you're kind of shocked if they ask you to pay more than $20 for one of these adventures. But anyway, all that changed, of course, with Telltale Games. Now, those guys, they started off, I think they did like a Texas Hold'em game. But anyway, these were mostly former Lucas guys, I suppose. And they had gotten a hold of the Sam & Max franchise. And they their breakthrough was, as you know, instead of releasing these big epic games that take, you know, a couple years to make, and all kinds of money, and then they try to sell it to you for $60, and you know, so they sort of lowered the stakes just by releasing episodes. So they churned out an episode a month, or I don't know how long it took them to make, but anyway, they could turn these things around fairly quickly, and I guess that also gave them a way to minimize the risk. So if nobody was buying the episodes, I guess they would just can the series, right, and go on to something else. But they did like a Monkey Island. Tales of Monkey Island series. Haven't played that, I have to say. I did play their remake. They did a remake of the first Monkey Island game, which that's pretty cool. Let's see. But I think they really got on the radar. Oh, I played their Sam & Max games too, by the way. Really fun. Really good games. But then they released the Walking Dead game. And that, I think they really got lucky with that. You know, the timing was just perfect. Now, I could be fudging my memory a little bit here, but it seems like they come out with those games right when that show, you know, started off as a comic. I don't know how long it was out as a comic before it went to a show, but I mean, once that show came out, you know, it was huge, 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 huge. And they, I mean, it could have been a turd. They would have sold a lot of copies of it, right? Just because of their, you know, the popularity of the show. But it was a great game. Great episodes. I mean, I love those games. I mean, they're right up there to me, just as good as the show or the comic. I really like the stories in the games, and they've done such a good job with the story in those things. I mean, as soon as you get to the end of an episode, it just kills you. You know, you have to wait for, you know, however long it takes for a new one to come out, especially that first season. Oh man, you know, it's rare that a game has gotten to me emotionally as much as those games did. You know, even if it had no connection to Walking Dead and it was just kind of generic zombies, I think I still would have enjoyed it very much. But having that franchise connection, I think, is what really put him over the top. And then after that, they did a game called Wolf Among Us, which is also based on a comic. You know, a lot of people say that they like that just as much as The Walking Dead or even more. Gotta admit, I haven't really, I played about halfway through the first episode. It really just, maybe I need to go back and play it some more, but it didn't really hook me the way that The Walking Dead one did. But, I have no doubt it's a great game. I just need to play it some more. And let's see what else. They've also, I don't know if they've done this already. Maybe I should, I didn't check to see, but I know they had a Back to the Future game. Like I say, I don't know if that's something that's out now or in development. And I've seen some ads for a Game of Thrones game from them, but I'm not really sure about those games. If you've played them, let me know what the status is, or if they're, how do they hold up compared to the Walking Dead series. Okay, and then I guess I could wrap this up, adventure game segment here. Just, of course, you have the Kickstarter. I mean, Tim Schafer's Double Fine Adventures just went through the roof. I mean, $3.3 million. I mean, that was just created a huge amount of buzz. Now, I have to admit, I played the Broken Age game that came out of that, Broken Age 1. And I just wasn't really, it was okay, I hope I'm not really upsetting people right now, but it to me, it wasn't as good as I wanted it to be. I don't know, maybe I've got some kind of nostalgia going on, but I just remember Full Throttle and just loving that game. I mean, just loving it. And same thing for Monkey Island and even Grim Fandango. Grim Fandango, even with the crappy interface, sorry, loved the game, right? But anyway, this Broken Age thing, it just didn't really do it for me. And I'm not really sure. I think they were supposed to do two games. And I'm not really sure what the status is on this. I know he's doing a Grim Fandango remake. I don't know if he's going to change it up or it's just going to be a remake. But it just seems like there might be something going on. I know some people have kind of gotten upset with him about this Kickstarter. I don't really know what's going on. I didn't really research that part. So let me know if you have thoughts on, Schafer and what he's been up to lately. But I did research the Thimbleweed Park game. This is Ron Gilbert and Gary Winnick, of course, of Maniac Mansion and Monkey Island. Have they done anything else? I'm sure they must have. It seems like Gilbert did that Bacon, some kind of silly RPG kind of game. That one didn't really do much for me either. But anyway, this one's kind of retro-themed. So it looks like 8-bit graphics or pixel graphics. It's all 2D, and it didn't raise that much money. I mean, they got more than twice, or right around twice what they asked for, but it's more like, I think, a couple hundred thousand, 300,000 instead of 3 million. Actually, let me correct that. I'm looking at the... I keep forgetting I'm in front of a computer. I can just pause this and look stuff up. Duh! Anyway, they were asking for 300... This is a Thimbleweed Park. So they were asking for $375,000, and they received $626,000. So that was more than... Actually, my math skills suck, but it looks like it's not quite twice what they're asking for, but still very nice. Now, it is a little... I am a little curious why this one didn't, go like Schafer's and just go through the roof. What would he have done? What would Gilbert and Winnick have done if they had raised $3 million? I don't even know if that's what they hoped for. But I think there's a couple of reasons. Obviously, the look of the game, these 2D graphics. I think a lot of people would look at this and probably think, well, that's not worth more than a $10 pledge or $5 pledge or maybe even not pledging at all. It just doesn't look like it's that expensive. Maybe it's not ambitious looking enough. I don't know. But Gilbert has said that basically he was okay as long as he makes enough to make another game. So I guess in that regards, they're fine. Personally, I'm not really sure how I feel about this one. There does seem to be a bit of a bandwagon on Steam right now and probably on GOG too. Haven't really checked on there, but there seems to be this glut of 2D, throwback, nostalgia, whatever you want to call it, sort of games where they basically look like a Nintendo era game or a Commodore 64 era game. And to me at that point, that sort of thing is just a novelty. It's not really something, it's kind of hard to take it seriously. You know, you can do the self-parody stuff. I'm playing one right now called Pixel Heroes, which is the same kind of thing. I mean, you're having a hoot. They're making fun of a lot of the conventions. But, I mean, as far as making a serious game, I'd have a hard time trying to get past. I mean, you know, it just looks a little too cartoony, you know, to take it seriously, which is fine if you're doing a sort of a, you know, a goofy sort of a lampoon, silly type of game. But, you know, a lot of my favorite adventure games were not that sort of style. You know, that was fine when I was younger, but now that I'm older, I like a little bit more of a mature kind of theme to an adventure. You know, again, I'm not talking about porn, but something like Jane Jensen, she's still doing the kind of games I like, where, you know, they don't treat you like you're some little kid. You're not just laughing all the time. I mean, there's some kind of serious drama going on. There's some, you know. But anyway, the Thimbleweed Park looks fun. I'm glad they met their goals. I really like the theme of this that, you know, it's supposedly like opening up your desk drawer and you find this old Lucasfilm game that you forgot about, never played. Now you get to play it. I don't remember where I mentioned this, but, you know, that actually happened to me with some of the, I think it was Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. And one of those Indiana Jones games, it had been on my list to play, but somehow I just never got around to playing it. And when I finally did, though, it was a real joy because it had aged so well. Maybe that's another point in Ron's favor here. You know, something about these cartoony-looking games, they tend to age better than the ones that do try to look, you know, realistic. Like Gabriel Knight 3, for example. Yeah, it's a bit hard to play that today. You know, I don't know about Phantasmagoria, I imagine, would be a real challenge to try to even get that running. I think that's probably on GOG, though. But, you know, again, the interface would probably give you pause. But all these scum VM games play really well on modern systems. So, anyway, kind of curious about this Thimbleweed Park game. But I got to admit, I'm kind of, you know, I supported that missed Kickstarter. That was called Abduction by Kyan and Incorporated. They asked for $1.1 million, got $1.3 million. Let's see. They're still trying to get a stretch goal. I wanted to see what their updates are. I don't think they've actually released the game yet. You know, hopefully that will come out soon, but I'm really looking forward to that. You know, it's nice to have it's nice to have variety, and it would be quite fun for me. I would actually love to have games like Thimbleweed Park coming out, and alongside that, games like Abduction coming out. And I think actually the Longest Journey guys had a Dreamfall. Yeah, Dreamfall Chapters. Is that out yet? So far behind. It's getting kind of absurd. This was back in March 2013. They had Dreamfall Chapters, The Longest Journey. And let's see. They asked for $850,000, got $1.5 million. Let's see, is this out yet? Yeah, I think they're already up to chapter 2, so I need to get on the ball. I wonder where I can buy this. All right, so it's on Steam, Dreamfall Chapters. Looks like you get Dreamfall Chapters $30. I wonder if there's a way just to buy the... You know, I don't understand why they won't let you just buy the individual episodes. You know, it's supposed to be episodic. Looks like the reviews are kind of mixed. 76% on that. I wonder. I don't even know if this is a point and click or if they have kind of done the Dreamfall. It's kind of hard to tell looking at the screenshots. Anyway, I'll have to check this out. If you guys are playing this, let me know. It looks like it was released on October 21st, 2014. So that's not that old. Okay, I feel a little better. I'm not that far behind the curve. I'll go ahead and purchase this, though, because It had to suck pretty hard before I wouldn't like it, because I love the first two. Really enjoyed those. All right, is there anything else going on with adventure games? You know, of course, you got lots of independent adventure games. Those seem to be... Oh, who's... Yeah, the independent games. You remember when I had had to look his name up, Dave Gilbert, on the show back in two... that was a... his game was called Deshiva. Let's see, when did I have him on? Matt Chet. That was back in 2013, so that's been a while. I need to catch up with him. But he had a lot of great games under his belt, some that he had published and some that he had designed himself. But Gemini Rue was one that I really was impressed with that. And it's kind of impressive that these games are still selling well. Yeah, Phoenix. What's his big series, though? It's not called... said like a ghost and a detective. Oh, jeez. Yeah, the Blackwell Legacy. I think he's still doing that. I think, when was that? Seems like just a couple days ago. Yeah, he released the last one on April, or the latest one anyway, on April 24th, 2014. And I played some of those, and they play very much like one of the, you know, good old Sierra, you know, not quite King's Quest V, somewhere in that vicinity, though. Really nice artwork. You know, of course, it doesn't look like a AAA game or anything. But definitely gets the job done, and very nice. All right, I think that's about all that I've got for you today. I really appreciate your listening. At some point, I'll see if I can do a little more homework next time. Not have to look all so much stuff up. Not sound like a complete ignoramus, but what the heck. It's kind of fun just to... There must be somebody that's just cringing every time I get some year wrong or whatever, but... anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed that. I'd really like to hear your thoughts on all the stuff we talked about. You know, do you notice any kind of a generation gap? Maybe you've got some younger brothers or maybe even kids, you know, that are of game-playing age, and you know, maybe they're all Pokemon, and, and couldn't give a rat's ass about the kind of games us oldsters play. Maybe you notice some difference. You know, I really like to hear from people that are really into anime and really into Japanese games, because that's just a huge gap in my, you know, knowledge. I don't really know much about that. I've always tried to get into it, but, you know, I think what I basically need is a, you know, like baby steps. You know, is there like a JRPG that I could, it's not so Japanese, you know, that I could sort of, you know, baby step my way into it, or the animes. You know, like I said, I've asked students this, and they pointed me towards that one called, Bleach. But even there, you know, I'm kind of struggling. You know, definitely struggling with that. So let me know what your thoughts are on that. And I think that'll do it. I wanted to talk about gender in games. I've got an opinion I think you guys would probably enjoy hearing about. But I think I'll save that for next time. Kind of a little afraid to even go near the topic. To be honest with you, nowadays it just seems like a very hostile environment for even people that are, you know, feminists to get wade into or whatever. But anyway, this'll do it, I think, for this episode. If you do have questions, comments, or whatever, please let me know. You can get in touch with me on YouTube, obviously, or on the Facebook Matt Chat page. I'm on Twitter. Of course, there's Matt Chat US. Basically, unlimited ways to contact me, but... Anyway, I'll see you guys soon.